6. The Truth About Mayberry. The Andy Griffith Show community extended itself to everyone in the Howard household. There were days when Dad had an acting gig of his own and couldn't be with Ron on set, so Mom would take over as his guardian, with me in tow. Many of my primordial memories are of the same stuff that Ron speaks of. The cigarette smoke, makeup melting under the hot lights, and the booming sound of Andy's voice. I was a free-range toddler, roaming everywhere with few limits placed on me at Desilu Cahuenga. Parked in corners of the sound stages were what are known in our business as flats, lightweight timber frames with plywood skins that are used as sets. When not in use, the flats were folded up and pushed together, creating fun three-dimensional passageways, a habit trail for a little kid like me. Even at home, the Andy Griffith Show provided me with play space. General Foods, the partner sponsor, sent us a massive supply of powdered Jell-O pudding mix. That was great, but the giant cardboard box that this stuff came in kept me occupied for hours. I hung out with Mrs. Barton at times in Ron's one-room schoolhouse, and I loved to visit the makeup room, the domain of Andy Griffith Show's larger-than-life makeup man, Lee Greenway. Lee was a proper Southern gentleman from Andy's home state of North Carolina, with white hair and a stocky body that made him look like Colonel Sanders minus the goatee. He kept a beautiful shotgun in the corner of the makeup room, a gift from Andy, with whom he sometimes went hunting. Lee was a polymath: makeup artist, marksman, musician, and practical joker. He once somehow tricked Andy into stepping into a pair of shoes that were nailed to the floor, causing Andy to pratfall. Everyone, including a slightly pissed off Andy, laughed uproariously. And when the bluegrass group the Dillards made their occasional appearances on the show as the Darlings, the musical hillbillies, Lee took out his banjo and jammed with them, proficiently. I loved Hal Smith the most. He played Mayberry's town drunk, Otis Campbell, and more impressively, he performed a ton of voices for the cartoons that Ron and I watched, such as Huckleberry Hound, The Flintstones, and Quick Draw McGraw. But coolest of all, Hal was the spokesman for the holiest of places in my early childhood universe, the International House of Pancakes. In this capacity, he made personal appearances in Chef's Whites and a puffy toque as the Pancake Man. He even hosted a local Pancake Man kid show for a time. And I knew Hal personally, the Pancake Man. Are you kidding me? Mom was no less delighted to be on set, befriending nearly everyone with whom she came in contact at Desilu Cahuenga. She and Helen McNair, the wife of Howard McNair, who played Floyd the Barber, really hit it off. 3 seasons in, Howard suffered a serious stroke that immobilized his left side and rendered him unable to stand or walk, less than ideal traits for an actor who was playing a barber. But Andy, ever magnanimous, didn't want to lose Howard or the Floyd character. So Helen came along to assist Howard in his comings and goings, appearing at the studio almost as often as Mom and Dad. I picked up my acting chops and on-set savvy by osmosis. My clothing landed me my first job. Dad loved anything to do with the Old West. Knowing this, Mom dressed me up as a toddler in a perfectly sized cowboy getup. Hat, kerchief, snap-button Western shirt, fringed buckskin jacket and boots. With my tousled blonde hair and chubby cheeks, I look friggin' adorable. Bob Sweeney, the show's director, certainly thought so. One day, Mom brought me to the set in this outfit, and Bob instantly came up with a role for me. At first, I was just an extra, but then the writers developed a running bit for my character, such as he was, named Leon. Leon, like Harpo Marx, never spoke. We never found out who his parents were, or if he even had parents. But he always wore a cowboy outfit and was always eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, usually with about half its contents smeared all over his face. A generous soul, Leon would come across a grown-up and thrust his sandwich in the adult's face in a, "Here, take a bite" gesture. The adult, usually flustered, would say, "No thank you, Leon." Leon's most common foil was Barney Fife, to whom he offered the sandwich at inopportune moments. The best-known one is when Barney is undercover in the sporting goods section of Weaver's department store, hoping to apprehend a shoplifter by posing stock still as a mannequin. Andy is fooled by Barney's disguise, but not Leon, who immediately recognizes the deputy and blows his cover by proffering the PB&J. In another episode, we did a bit where Leon accidentally locked Barney in the jail cell. That day I took a swig from Otis's jug, which was filled not with hooch, but apple juice, my then drink of choice. Just like that, I too was in the business. Like Ron's career, mine began organically, as a matter of circumstance. The difference for me is that Ron had provided a blueprint. My folks now knew that if I wanted to go down the same route, they could manage it.
The way Andy dealt with Howard McNear's stroke was such a lesson to me on multiple levels. Andy had the crew rig up a wooden support with a small backrest for Howard to lean against in the scenes that required Floyd to stand. To create the illusion of Floyd as a working barber, the wardrobe people draped his smock in such a way as to hide the stand that supported Howard's half-immobilized body and made sure that Howard always clutched something in his non-working hand, a comb or a newspaper. Then the cameraman framed the shot just so. This taught me yet again that there were almost no limits to what can be achieved in motion pictures through ingenuity. Where there's a will, there's a way. And the illusion came off with viewers none the wiser, an accomplishment as humane as it was heroic. Pulling off this operation took grace and strength by Andy and by Howard, and Helen too. Another of Andy's attempts at accommodation didn't work out so well. In a 1963 episode called A Black Day for Mayberry, a top-secret gold shipment passes through Mayberry en route to Fort Knox. Two U.S. Treasury agents come to town on the lookout for a crook who has designs on the gold. For one of the agent roles, Andy cast an old friend. I could sense that Andy was both happy to see his friend and a little anxious. During rehearsals, Andy was not his usual relaxed, wisecracking self. His eyes were full of concern rather than their usual sparkle. Opie was in the scene with the Treasury agents, so I was on set when they did the master shot, in which the agents sit on wooden chairs in the Mayberry courthouse waiting to meet with the sheriff. Everything went smoothly to that point. Then the crew repositioned the cameras for a closer shot on Andy's friend, who would explain the case and describe the suspect. In the first take, the actor fumbled his lines. No big deal. Bob Sweeney, the director, simply called for another take, and the makeup people attended to the actor's brow. I sat right next to the camera during the second take, which went disturbingly wrong. Andy's friend began the agent speech, performing it reasonably well at first, but then it drifted off course into something personal, not having to do with the character or the episode. It was instead an apologetic monologue, delivered with a pained expression. He rambled on about Andy's success and his own personal and professional frustration. Then he broke into sobs. Bob Sweeney whispered cut to the camera operator. We were no longer rolling, and for a moment, no one knew quite what to do. Then Andy's friend literally slid off the chair he was sitting in and fell to the floor, curling up in a fetal position and bawling uncontrollably. Andy rushed to his friend's side and, with Bob's help, got him back upright and loosened his tie. Then they gently walked him off the set. Later, Andy told everyone that his friend had been struggling with emotional and psychiatric issues. He had hoped that giving his buddy a part on the show would help in the man's recovery. Alas, it seemed to have had the opposite effect. This incident marked the first time I was conscious of mental illness and its toll. I've carried the image of that actor's anguished, helpless face with me ever since. I drew upon my memory of him more than 30 years later when I made the film A Beautiful Mind. The film stars Russell Crowe as John Nash, a real-life mathematician and Nobel laureate whose schizophrenia led to his institutionalization. When we filmed scenes depicting Nash's mental unraveling, I innately understood not only his suffering, but that of those who bore witness to it. I recalled the visceral fear and panic that rippled through the set that day in the 1960s, the disruptive impact it had on a room full of people who couldn't fathom what they were seeing. These recollections influenced my approach to Nash's story. Dad was a help to me in processing what had happened. Fortunately, he was on set that day, giving me someone to turn to after witnessing the man's breakdown. His presence also benefited the Andy Griffith Show because they had a good actor on the premises who could immediately be pressed into service. Dad put on a suit of Andy's and learned the character's lines. We reshot the scene. Dad nailed it, and his close-up speech, too. But there were uncharacteristically few laughs that day. Everyone was shaken. This jarring introduction to the toll that our pressure-filled line of work could have on fragile people has stayed with me. The critics never much cared for us. The Andy Griffith Show appears to be only mildly entertaining, said the New York Times in October 1960, our first month on the air. That was one of the friendlier reviews we received. But we were a ratings hit from the get-go. We finished at number 4 in the Nielsen rankings that season and never looked back. A top 10 program for all 8 seasons of the program's life. Mayberry struck a chord. It was sweet without being hokey and funny without being farcical. In Andy Taylor, the sheriff without a gun, America found the gentle authority figure that it craved. An easygoing fellow with a humorously imperfect but ultimately viable approach to crisis management. I've since come to believe that Sheldon Leonard's experience working with Frank Capra must have informed our show, since tonally, it's the closest a sitcom ever got to Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, and It's a Wonderful Life. I brought this up to Andy years later, and he said that the subject of Capra never came up in his discussions with Sheldon. But I witnessed these great triangular conversations between Andy, Sheldon, and Aaron Rubin, who was brilliant in his own right. He had written for Milton Berle, Sid Caesar, and Phil Silvers, and they were like alchemy. Out of the mix of these three sensibilities, one Southern rural and two urban Jewish, came TV gold. Andy, like all of us, learned on the job. He later said that he played Andy Taylor too broadly that first season, still steeped in the rube-like Southerners he had played in the past. He progressively dialed down Sheriff Andy's theatrics and turned himself into the show's straight man and voice of reason. Me, I was a sponge, absorbing the intricacies of how television was made by observing all the different craftsmen at work. I regarded the set with a sense of mystery and excitement. What did all these people do? How did the camera actually work? Why did they have to change lenses all the time? What were the sets made of? Who painted them and made them look real? In the Renaissance era, the artisan class put its children to work as apprentices young, enlisting their help to create devotional frescoes and sculptures. The kids started out at age 5 or 6, cleaning brushes and tools, and slowly took on greater responsibilities as they began to better understand the craft, which in turn fostered a better understanding of the artistry involved. That parallels my trajectory on The Andy Griffith Show, as I gradually figured out how and why television worked. Howard Morris took notice of my curiosity. A frenetic comic actor, Howard had a recurring role on the show as Ernest T. Bass, the fast-talking, perpetually unshaven mountain man who always greeted Andy and Barney by saying, "Howdy do to you and you." Howard was an outlier among the cast, a Jewish guy from the Bronx who had been one of the repertory players on Your Show of Shows alongside Sid Caesar, Carl Reiner, and Imogene Coca. But the very fact that he had worked with such TV legends meant that his words carried weight. Howard observed me observing and offered up some pro tips. One day he saw me squinting at a row of reflector boards, the large, flat cards that redirect light onto the actors' faces. "Are those shiny boards hurting your eyes, Ronnie?" he asked. Wilting in the heat and barely able to see, I weakly nodded yes. "Good," he said. "If a TV actor is in a little pain, it means they're right on their mark." Howard then asked me how old I was. 10, I said. "I noticed the way your eyes follow the camera when shots are being set up, and the way you pay attention to all the back and forth during rehearsals, whether it involves Opie or not. Ronnie, I bet you're going to be a director when you grow up," he said. I can identify earlier moments that laid the groundwork for the path I would pursue, but Howard's actually saying it put the thought into my head. 20 years later, I cast Howard in my third feature film, Splash, as an eccentric marine biologist with expertise in mermaids. I reminded him of his prediction. Howard smiled warmly and zinged me in customary Morrisonian fashion. "And this is what I get for my clarity of vision? A day on a Disney movie?" My early years of apprenticeship in the trade were not without their disappointments. I was bummed, for example, to discover that I would not get to eat ice cream when Opie had an ice cream scene. The hot lights melted any frozen dessert in a matter of seconds, so my cones were filled with cold, lumpy mashed potatoes. I mean, try licking that and smiling ear to ear as a 6-year-old. Now that is some acting to be proud of. The fried chicken, at least, was real. Reggie, the prop man, cooked it to order. It was and remains the best fried chicken I have ever eaten. On the days when the script called for Aunt Bee to serve a fried chicken dinner, a bewitching smell wafted onto the set from the prop room, and I could barely focus on my lines. To land on this show, of all shows as a kid, was the ultimate stroke of good fortune. Andy oversaw it all as the boss, but he thrived on collaboration and welcomed the cast's input. My first few attempts at chiming in were politely rebuffed. But one day, pretty early on, in the second episode of the second season, I piped up again. On a Friday, the day that we ran full rehearsals before committing an episode to film, I raised my hand to get the attention of Bob Sweeney, our director. "What is it, Ronnie?" he said. I explained that the line that I had just said, I can't even remember precisely what it was, just that it was an interjection of, "Hey, Paul, something, something," didn't sound authentically kid-like. I pitched my little rewrite of the line, and Bob said, "Good, I like it. Say it that way." A rush of satisfaction coursed through me. I guess I didn't make any effort to hide it because Andy looked straight at me and said, "What are you grinning at, young'un?" I said, "That's the first suggestion of mine that you've ever taken." Andy, not missing a beat, said, "Well, it was the first one that was any damn good. Now let's get on with the scene." I doubt that Andy even remembered that moment, but I have carried this revelation, this discovery of my potential to influence others ever since. My appreciation of how seriously I was taken as a human being with ideas and agency, not only by Andy, but also my own parents, has only deepened with time. Nowadays, I am often the veteran on the set. I try to be conscious of the effect that my words and actions have on the people with whom I'm working, mindful of how one single comment could affect someone's life trajectory, just as Bob and Andy's comments affected mine. The shared mission aspect of the Andy Griffith Show was a special thing to be a part of. I learned that success didn't need to be painful or punishing, though it did require hard work. Andy made everyone run their lines until they flowed naturally. As soon as we finished one scene, he asked us to pull our chairs together in a circle to start running lines for the next one. This disciplined approach clearly paid off. We had all been given those director's chairs with our names on them. No one ever cared about who sat in which chair. We just grabbed the chairs nearest to us. So I might have been in Andy's chair, Andy in Francis's chair, and Francis in my chair, with no sense of hierarchical protocols and etiquette. I never understood how relaxed our set was until years later, when post-Andy Griffith, but pre-Happy Days, I did an episode of MASH. I grabbed a seat between Alan Alda and Wayne Rogers to catch up on my high school algebra during a break. Loretta Swit walked in, and I didn't notice her glowering at me. I cluelessly said, "Hey, Loretta, how are you doing?" She replied, "You're in my chair." I sheepishly made my exit. That chair clearly meant something to her that no piece of furniture had ever meant to any Andy Griffith actor. Andy had a wonderful facility for getting everyone, actors and writers alike, to up their game for the cause. If he worried that our energy was flagging or that a scene wasn't coming together as it should, he summoned Carl and Ethel. Carl and Ethel were an imaginary couple watching at home, commenting on the show in real time as we filmed. Carl, who sounded like a cranky relation of Andy's back in Mount Airy, would butt in to say, "Well, Ethel, I think we can turn this off. It doesn't make any damn sense." Or, "Well, Ethel, I've been waiting 20 minutes to laugh at something. Shoot, I'm going to go get me something to eat." Poor Ethel was never given the chance to speak. She just mutely endured Carl's rants about the slack moments in certain Andy Griffith Show episodes. Carl and Ethel proved an effective means to get the writers cracking, working on the fly to sharpen jokes and scenes. Invariably, these rewrites paid off, improving the episode we were shooting. And Andy was not above calling himself out when his own material lacked punch. One day he leaped up after we had completed a read-through to pitch a comedy idea that he had just come up with, acting it out in front of us. For all his enthusiasm, our reaction was tepid. Andy shook his head and said, "I should have known not to break my own rule. Never, ever stand up and move around to pitch a joke, because it's a long walk back to your chair if it dies." That got a laugh. A perk of working on a series, as opposed to my earlier a la carte experiences with TV employment, was the amount of hang time on the set. It fostered a sense of family, in that we all really got to know one another. Andy turned our downtime into a talk show of sorts, feeding prompts to the various members of the cast. He egged on Don Knotts, 3 years older than Andy and a World War II veteran, to tell stories of his time in the South Pacific. Don told us he had performed as a ventriloquist for the Special Services in a GI review called Stars and Gripes. At some point, Don said, he grew sick of being upstaged by his own dummy, whose name was Danny Hooch Matador, and he tossed Hooch overboard into the drink. Don claimed that as the ship sailed away, the dummy could be heard gargling his angry protests through mouthfuls of seawater. Howard McNear regaled us with stories of his life in vaudeville and the U.S. Army Air Corps. Crucially, Andy included my father in these conversations, too. "Rance, your turn." It speaks volumes of Andy that he considered my father a member of the Mayberry crew, not merely Ronnie Howard's guardian. Dad's rural bona fides didn't hurt. We were unique among TV programs in that we had a lot of actors from that kind of background. Andy, Don, and the esteemed Pyle cousins, Gomer and Goober, whose portrayers, Jim Nabors and George Lindsay, came from relatively small towns in Alabama. I later heard stories of friction between Andy and Francis Bavier, though I never saw anything of the sort. My picture of Francis is of an elegant, urbane woman who simply chose to stay out of the fray. She put on a slight Southern accent to play Aunt Bee, but she spoke completely differently in real life, like the conservatory-trained New Yorker she was. She generally spent her breaks reading the New York Times and doing the crossword puzzle with a thin, ladies' brand cigarette between her fingers. As our storytellers went, Andy was the most uninhibited. I was mildly scandalized when he told everyone he had been rendered sterile by a bout of mumps in his teens, so he and his wife had adopted their children. His candor was laudable, but the very subject of sterility was a new one to my virgin ears. I sort of understood what Andy meant from the context of the story, but Dad preemptively took the opportunity to explain the concept in greater detail in the car ride home that day. He explained that lots of people in his and Andy's generation came down with the mumps, but he was lucky not to have had a case so bad as Andy's. "I'm glad you weren't sterile, Dad," I said, brimming with sincerity. "Well, me too, Ronnie. I feel very lucky about that." Don Knotts fascinated me to no end. He was the least like the character he played, the high-strung, forever nervous Barney Fife. It's hard for most people to even picture Don as a normal human being because the two characters for which he is best known, Barney and Mr. Furley from Three's Company, are absurd in the extreme. Off camera, though, Don was reserved and self-effacing. Whereas Andy was essentially playing a version of himself, Barney Fife was someone who Don had to become. I'd watched this amazing metamorphosis take place before my eyes, much as when Bert Lahr turned it on for Mr. O'Malley. Still, Don could be drawn out. Andy adored him. No one could make him laugh more than Don could. In fact, as much as Andy sometimes called upon Carl and Ethel to liven things up when he felt we all needed a fire lit under us, he also nudged Don when he needed a personal pick-me-up. Andy was a religious man, and his usual approach was to start singing an old-time hymn in a deep, low bass. "When we all get to heaven." Without fail, Don would pick up on Andy's intent and come in with a high, yawping falsetto, engaging Andy in a gospel call and response. When we all get to heaven, get to heaven. Don would take it from there, screeching, "What a day of rejoicing that will be!" It killed every time. He had us all in stitches, but no one more than Andy, who doubled over, crying tears of laughter. The Andy Griffith Show's success was so huge and immediate that I had an up-close look at how fame and money affected people. It started with the cars getting nicer in the Desilu Coanga lot. Andy collected antique cars and was stunned when someone gave him a Model T Ford as a gift. And the Ford Motor Company itself bestowed a new car upon him for driving a Galaxy on the show. "Now that I'm rich, people are giving me cars," he exclaimed. "That's real nice and all, but where the hell were they when I was dirt poor?" Don became a Cadillac man, buying a new one every year. Francis splashed out on a Studebaker in 1961. Being a frugal, sensible person, she kept it for the remainder of the program's run, parking it in the space next to ours. Sometimes the adult conversations I overheard at work were more adult stuff that wasn't meant for my ears but wasn't censored. The cast was too accustomed to having little Ronnie around. Andy and Don maintained an ongoing conversation about how they had essentially won the lottery, but weren't necessarily the happier for it. Both of them were in troubled marriages whose issues predated our show. Don got divorced from his wife, Catherine, in 1964, and Andy finally split up with his wife, Barbara, in 1972. And both men were visiting psychotherapists to work through their stuff. I often found myself alongside Andy and Don in one of Lee Greenway's makeup chairs, tissues tucked into my collar, while Andy described to Don at high volume his latest session with his shrink. He started talking about latent homosexuality. "I don't think I qualify for that one, but I don't know. What about you, Don?" Andy was definitely the more forthright about personal stuff like this. Don would eagerly get into a back and forth with him if the conversation turned to subjects like tax shelters, which interested them both because the top marginal tax rate in those days, for which they newly qualified, was a whopping 91%. but Don would just quietly nod when Andy declared, within earshot of the whole cast, "My psychiatrist told me that probably the reason I work so damn hard on this show is that I don't want to go home to my wife. And you know what, Don? I think he's right." Andy wasn't saying these things to get laughs. As his marriage to Barbara was unraveling, I saw him endure genuine pain. He came back from Christmas break one season with his hand all taped up. He was blunt about what happened. "I got drunk, I got mad, and I put my fist through a door." Of the two piles, Gomer and Goober, I was closer to the latter, or rather the man who played him, George Lindsay. George was a tall man and an athlete who took me under his wing when he saw I was getting into sports, baseball and basketball especially. He threw me batting practice and played games of horse with me under the hoop that had been nailed up on the inside of the stage one door. Thanks in part to George's tutelage, I became a good enough shooter to tie for first at a Burbank Parks Department free throw contest where I made 47 out of 50 shots. I wasn't as close with Jim Nabors, though he was an extremely nice man. It took me until the 80s, when we did the Return to Mayberry reunion film, for me to discover that Jim was not just this friendly, golly goofball, but a worldly, intelligent guy with whom I would enjoy having conversations. When I was a kid, though, Mom became friends with Jim. He adored her company and considered her a confidant, almost a second mother, though she had only 2 years on him. In the workplace, Jim, while private about his private life, was not closeted. He didn't pretend to date women or insist he wasn't gay. Mom explained this to me when I grew a little older in my post-Opie years. Everyone in the cast knew the deal about Jim's sexuality, but it went uncommented upon, a Hollywood version of don't ask, don't tell. The crew, unfortunately, was not as enlightened. Listening to their on-set chatter, I heard a word I didn't know. Homo. That's what they called Jim behind his back, and not with any hint of kindness. Something about this word didn't feel right. "Dad," I said one day, "what is a homo?" He instantly understood the context, and he offered his usual plain-spoken response. "Jim is attracted to men instead of women," Dad said, "and they call that homosexuality." The definition was framed this narrowly only as it related to Jim, really. I didn't yet understand that there were gay people all around me and all across the world. But this was my introduction to the very concept of queerness. Mayberry was a small town, but for those of us who actually spent our days there, it contained the whole of human experience.